You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Tell me if this sounds familiar. You've been cooking dinners all week, and when you open up the fridge on Friday, you've got a bunch of extra ingredients you need to use up. Maybe a big hunk of mozzarella from homemade pizza, a ton of leftover fresh parsley after a pasta dinner, or a huge chunk of celery if you use just one or two of the stalks. How do you put all that food to use and keep it out of the trash? Our Food Friday guest has recipes for all your food extras and advice for reducing food waste. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have those ingredients that you have a hard time using up before they go bad? Have you come up with recipes, ways to make use of those ingredients? Do you compost stuff? How important is reducing food waste to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexis Dabashnik is a recipe developer based in New York. She's the author of the new cookbook, To the Last Bite, Recipes and Ideas for Making the Most of Your Ingredients. Alexis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that your mom was someone who really practiced this philosophy of wasting as little as possible. Obviously, you picked that up. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, I think as many of us, when I was a kid, I didn't appreciate it. And then growing up and kind of looking back at her ethos, I was like, oh, this is, you know, not totally unique, but definitely something special as we're all trying to be a little more sustainable in our everyday lives. She was kind of embodying that, you know, all along.
Now, this isn't just a treatise on food waste. This is a cookbook with lots of recipes. Can you talk about, apart from the food waste, which we'll get into a bit, just your approach to coming up with and developing recipes?
Totally. I mean, I like to create recipes that are high impact with low effort. So that's using a handful of ingredients to get you really the most flavor and really exciting dishes with some unique combinations. And the book is actually broken out. You know, you can look at it like a regular old cookbook. It's broken out into the familiar sections or in this kind of choose your own adventure way. And that's kind of the way to use up the food waste.
Right. Literally, there's a recipe and then down there's like a footnote like, hey, this is the thing you're going to have left over. And so you point toward other things that you can make with that in the cookbook. And honestly, that's often the way I cook. Like, what is in the fridge that I need to use up with before it goes bad? Is that your starting point a lot of the time?
Yeah, I pulled a lot of friends and family and was like, what do you waste? What's left over? And most people said produce and dairy. So that's really what I focused on. Although there's a few other things in there too, but you know, using up that container of sour cream, using up that bunch of celery, you know, that bunch of parsley, figuring out ways to use up these ingredients, you know, that's more than just a tablespoon, using a whole can of tomato paste so you don't have that like lingering bit left in the fridge.
Guilty on all charges. You mentioned celery, and let's go right there. You gave us some recipes. We've got them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Yeah, celery is a big one for me. I make some soup, but want a little celery in it, but you have to buy it in this like 8-pound brick of celery, and I use a stalk or two. You gave us a celery salad with walnuts and pecorino. Tell us about this.
Yes. I mean, I feel like celery is rarely the star of the show. And I really wanted to create a recipe that, you know, gave it its due. You know, it has a really delicious, punchy dressing with it. There's cheese, there's crunchy walnuts. You're getting kind of all these great flavors. And I have to say, everyone who's made it is such a fan.
That's celery salad with walnuts and pecorino. Find it at WPR.org/Food Friday. Alexis Dabashnik is with us. Her new cookbook is called To the Last Bite, Recipes and Ideas for Making the Most of Your Ingredients. Yummy food, but also figuring out what to do with those odds and ends that get left over. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that challenge? The thing that, you know, you use part of it and then it sits in the fridge. You don't know what to do with it. Do you need some advice, or did you figure out what to do with the stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Here's one, Alexis. You know, sometimes I'm cooking and a recipe wants just the egg white or just the egg yolk. And it feels like a big waste. You're throwing away half the egg. What do you do with the half the egg that's left over?
Well, it depends. You know, if you have an egg yolk left over, you can add it to a dressing that's like the base of a Caesar salad dressing. It just adds some like great creaminess, actually used in that celery salad we just talked about. If you have an egg white, you can add it to, you can make a little meringue. You can also add it to some like granola, homemade granola with an egg yolk, actually with an egg white, sorry, makes
Really?
it really like clumpy and golden and kind of that classic granola look.
Now, you are worried not just about good food, but also some about the environmental benefits of reducing food waste. Can you talk about that?
Totally. I mean, I think we're all trying to be a little more conscious, but it's really hard to know where to start. And I thought, why don't we just start with our own kitchens? There's some really easy ways to start cutting down on food waste, by composting, by making a grocery list before you go out to shop, rather than just saying like, oh, what looks good? Most of us can't eat like 7 pounds of fresh fruit as much as we want to. So really going in with intention. And I really wanted to inspire people to just think, a little more consciously and creatively in the kitchen.
Now, you're in New York State right now. I think you got a pretty similar climate and growing environment to us here in
Yes.
Wisconsin. What kind of ingredients are you having maybe a glut of right now where the issue is, what do I do with all of this blank?
Well, we're still pretty early in our growing season. I mean, we had a storm about a month ago with a foot of snow, so we're off to a late start here. So I don't think we're having much of a glut of anything, but we have lettuce out for the first time in months now, which is very exciting. So we're just trying to eat as many salads as possible.
Let's check out another recipe you shared with us, whipped feta and charred scallion dip. Feta, I know sometimes I have leftover, I use a little bit of it in a, with my chicken shawarma or whatever. Can you talk about this? This sounds like a really good dip.
Totally. I mean, it's a great way to use up feta, to use up sour cream. You're getting a lot of punch from the lime and some paprika in there, and the charred scallions. It's kind of an optional thing, but it adds just this great like smoky flavor. It's really like, think of it like the new onion dip.
Now, what
Charred scallion feta dip is the new onion dip, everyone.
that sounds really good. Now, scallions are one of those things where you can use a lot more of the vegetable than I would have thought, right? Like I can just sometimes I like
Totally.
daintily just chop off the white bits and goodbye to the greens. Like you could use the whole darn thing, right?
Exactly. And that's something I talk about in the book too. Using parts of the ingredient that we might not, like the fennel stalks, like those are totally edible and delicious.
I'll admit I'm not a big fan of any part of the fennel, but hey, more power to you. Now leeks. Did I read that's one where I don't? Oh, I think. Oh, the greens are going to be too tough. I'm not going up that far. If we treat them right, we could still eat them.
I mean, totally. It just takes, some good butter or olive oil and just sauteing them down, and they become silky and delicious. And add a little salt, and you've got a side dish.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Alexis Dobochnik, author of the new cookbook, To the Last Bite: Recipes and Ideas for Making the Most of Your Ingredients. She's got some recipes for us over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now is your turn. We want to hear from you. Do you have a hard time using up all the leftover ingredients in your fridge? You bought a lot. You only had to use a little. You need some advice on what to do with it? Maybe it's in your fridge right now. Or have you come up with great ways to use extra food? I'm a big fan of making soup, for example, like fridge soup, I call it, whatever's in there within reason. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you found a tactic or a strategy for cutting back on food waste in your own life? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday talk with Alexis Dobochnik about her new cookbook. It's called To the Last Bite: Recipes and Ideas for Making the Most of Your Ingredients. So good recipes, but also ways to use up the stuff that might go to waste otherwise, the stuff you use a little bit of and then it goes to mold in your fridge. Call 800-642-1234 if you have a problem in need of a solution or you've come up with solutions of your own to cut back on wasted food. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Esther is with us in Deer Park. Esther, hi.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to mention that when I have too much of one ingredient, if it's freezable, I will freeze it. Also, like cake mixes, it's just my husband and myself. I only use half of the cake mix and mix up half of the ingredients into the mix and then seal up the box and save the rest for another time.
Interesting. And Esther,
I've also found online that you can freeze certain canned goods like cream of mushroom soup, put it in a tight container, and or tomato products like diced tomatoes, tomato paste, and that sort of thing.
And Esther, my problem is I'll freeze stuff and then I kind of lose track of it. I'm getting better at labeling stuff. Do you have a pretty good organizing system to remember what you've got tucked away in the freezer?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like people forget how much you can freeze.
Yeah, exactly. Esther, thank you so much for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Alexis, how big a part of your strategy for avoiding food waste is the freezer?
Oh, huge. I mean, there's so many recipes that I mentioned where it's like, save this in the freezer for later or use it for X recipe. I mean, yeah, people should make better use of their freezers.
And thanks again for that call, Esther. You mentioned, Alexis, people could freeze more stuff than maybe we think we can. Like, what kind of things might we expand our horizons to in the freezer?
I mean, I think Esther called out a great one in tomato paste. Like, if you don't use that full can, scoop it out, put it in the freezer, and then you can just, you know, microwave it for a second when you need it or add it straight to the pot, and it, you know, defrosts really quickly. But I think soups, certain vegetables, fruit even, you know, there's a lot of ways to make use of the freezer.
Thanks again, Esther, for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Jacqueline on the Ideas Network Facebook page who says, fried rice is a go-to recipe for using up extras.
Yes.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of kinds of foods, like a stir fry or fried rice. My soups are a way I clear the fridge a lot of the time. Are there other good sort of like, yeah, there's a dish and you make it with what you got that you like to go to, Alexis?
Totally. I mean, fried rice is one of my favorites because I feel like you can add pretty much anything in there. The same goes for something like a frittata or a quiche. You know, you can really load it with all your leftovers.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 during our Food Friday conversation about cooking and using stuff up and avoiding food waste. 800-642-1234. Alexis Dubochnik is with us. Her new cookbook is called To the Last Bite. Let's check out another recipe you've got for us, Alexis, WPR.org/Food Friday. People can find that. I love the sound of this one. Mustardy pork tenderloin with grapes and red onions. So grapes is the surprising word there for me. How does a grape fit into this?
Well, I have to be honest, I don't love just eating a grape as is, but in savory preparations, either roasted or sauteed, I think they're delicious. So the grapes just kind of soften and add like a little bit of sweetness, and they add some great, great texture to this dish. It's also a great way to use up your grapes. You know, if you buy too many of them and they're starting to kind of wilt down, just use them in this preparation and you'd never know the difference.
Yeah, I use grapes in salad all the time. I think it's just not on my radar to cook with them.
Totally. I mean, it's so easy too. It takes like, you know, 10, 15 minutes and they're good to go.
Now the pork tenderloin, can you give us some variations on that? Mustard, grapes, and red onions. Well, I don't have the grapes today or the red onions. What are some different things we might substitute in there?
Totally. I mean, again, you can use like ingredients. So if you don't have red onions, you could use leeks or you could use shallots or even scallions. If you don't have grapes, like, leave it out. It's totally fine. You know, if you don't have pork tenderloin, you could do something similar with chicken thighs or even with, you know, like a nice piece of fish like cod or a halibut or something like that.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Madison. Laura, hi.
Hi.
What's your advice, Laura?
My advice is cook once and eat two or three times.
So you make a big batch to start with?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You know, like roasted chicken, you can turn that into quesadillas or tacos or chicken pasta or, you know, short ribs.
I got it.
Those and the, yeah.
So, Laura, I got to say, I like that you do it with that variety because I used to be the guy who would make a pot of rice and beans or spaghetti or whatever and eat it every day for a week. And then, of course, I'd be sick of it. So you've put some advanced thought into making sure you've got some variety?
Yeah. I usually think about what my second or third meal will be when I am making the first one or grocery shopping for the first one.
Fantastic, Laura. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Alexis, that's totally in the spirit of your cookbook, I think.
Totally. I love that so much. And there's a few recipes that are, you know, similar to that, a chicken salad recipe. I mean, kind of the most obvious way to use up leftover chicken, but a great one.
And Laura mentioned actually being at the grocery store and having that in mind. And you talk about that little grocery store discipline as we're buying stuff to help us avoid waste, to give us the right mindset for shopping.
Totally. I think just a little bit of preparation, you know, taking 5 minutes to take stock of what you already have, making a list and going from there will save you, you know, time, money, and, you know, of course, cutting down on food waste.
We heard from our own Aubrey Ralph in the engineering department here. It says, on cakes, we cut and freeze the pieces. Then we have cake for a month, which is probably way smarter than my strategy of eating all the pieces in a day or two. Cake, generally speaking, I think freezes, when I have had the discipline to do that, cake, something like that, freezes pretty well, Alexis.
It freezes so well. And I love the idea, too, from earlier of only using half the cake mix. I mean, so smart.
We are having a Food Friday conversation, cooking with Alexis Dubochnik. Her new cookbook is called To the Last Bite, Recipes and Ideas for Making the Most of Your Ingredients. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234 with Michael on the line in Appleton. Hi, Michael.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a couple of quick comments. I heard fried rice mentioned, and that's one of my favorite leftover things to do, especially because it works so much better with leftover rice. And you can throw whatever vegetables, whatever meat you kind of have, and you can spice it up differently, and just super versatile. And then if people are trying to, like I am, eat less red meat, a great substitution for like a pork tenderloin is turkey tenderloin. And that's it. Thanks.
Yeah, I've used those myself, Michael. Thanks a lot for that call. And Michael says he's trying to use less red meat. And Alexis, you, I think, mentioned in the intro to your book, there's meat in the book, but you try to provide some options and not have everything be dependent on meat as the center of a dish.
Totally. I think, you know, collectively, a lot of us are trying to eat less meat in general and trying to, you know, use it for more celebratory purposes rather than an everyday thing. So I really also focused on, you know, a lot of vegetarian mains that people could get excited about, like eggplant parm, for instance.
Well, here's another one. And this is the fourth recipe you gave us at WPR.org/Food Friday, pasta with tomato confit and ricotta. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Oh, that's one of my favorite recipes. And it's, you know, if tomatoes are abundant and you don't know what to do with them, tomato confit is an amazing way to use them. You basically slow roast them in an oven with a lot of olive oil and aromatics like herbs and garlic. And the texture and the smell, it's just so good. It kind of makes this instant tomato sauce. And adding a dollop of ricotta on pretty much anything just makes it feel so celebratory and delicious. You know, this is kind of like a under, you know, $10 meal, and it feels like it's restaurant worthy.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Mary, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Mary?
Yeah, so one of my favorite go-tos, I have a almost two-year-old, so sometimes it's hard to get him to eat vegetables or breakfast foods. So one of my favorite go-tos is if I have leftovers from a vegetable dish from the night before, or even a soup, I'll put it in my little mini waffle maker with some eggs and cheese. And it's a great little breakfast waffle.
That is
such a good idea.
I love it, Mary. You know, this has been years now. I talked to a guy who wrote a book, Will It Waffle, where he had just like spent years experimenting with what he could and couldn't put on his waffle maker. Mary, I love that. And I do some of that in fall. I like to make, I call them squaffles with squash, with their waffles.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Mary, thank you so much for sharing that. Alexis, getting creative like that with some of the gear in our kitchen, what do you think?
Oh my God, I love it. I mean, as she was saying that, I was thinking like, oh, you could kind of do the same thing with like a fritter. You know, if you don't have a waffle iron, you know, which a lot of us don't, you know, you could do the same kind of idea with a fritter, which is so good. It's so creative. I love it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mary. Alexis, what's your advice to that home cook who's staring right now at a pile of, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that in their fridge and thinking, I don't know what to do with this. I'm going to toss it.
I mean, I don't know about you, but it's kind of dreary here today. And I'm thinking like a good old pantry pasta. Use up those little bits to make some good pantry pasta. Saute some veggies, add some good cheese, maybe add a little, you know, hard salami in there and you've got dinner.
And of course, some stuff we're just not going to eat or maybe can't eat. You're a big fan, I think, of composting. And I've got a composter in my backyard, getting some great material out of it for the garden this year. Can you make the case for people to try composting what they can't eat?
Totally. I mean, it's such an easy way to cut down on food waste. And if you don't have, you know, if you don't have a backyard, you can do the old freezer method, which is basically just putting your scraps into a bag or a bin in the freezer and, you know, doing a weekly deposit from there. Super easy way. And you'll be amazed at how much you can save from the trash.
Ooh, one more question. Sometimes your recipe calls for a bunch of fresh herbs. You pay sometimes a lot of money for it, but just using a little bit of sprigs. You've got those fresh herbs left. Leave us with some advice on what to do with that.
I think my biggest advice with fresh herbs is, you know, you don't have to buy all of them all the time, but find, you know, a few of your favorites. And a lot with tender herbs like parsley or dill or cilantro, you can actually use the stem. So if you just finely chop it, you can just add it with the rest of the herbs and it just adds even more flavor. No need to throw it away.
Alexis, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Alexis Dubochnik. She's a recipe developer based in New York with us today to talk about her new cookbook. It's called To the Last Bite, Recipes and Ideas for Making the Most of Your Ingredients. You can find a link to it and four recipes we talked about today. Find them at WPR.org/Food Friday. That mustardy pork tenderloin with grapes and red onions, pasta with tomato confit and ricotta, celery salad with walnuts and pecorino, and whipped feta and charred scallion dip. Getting hungry? They're all at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it takes a steady hand and a keen eye to become a Lego champion. Meet a pair of brothers who are on the competitive Lego circuit and find out about the existence of a competitive Lego circuit. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, between the Sandy Hook massacre just under a decade ago and this week's shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, not much has changed when it comes to gun laws. After an 18-year-old killed 19 children and two teachers with an AR-15-style weapon, some members of the U.S. Senate say they are working to negotiate something that they can agree on. This comes as the NRA meets in Texas now and through the weekend amid protests at the meeting site. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you believe is the answer to preventing mass shootings? Do you think we need more or fewer guns to combat gun violence? Are you a teacher or a parent with kids in school? What are you thinking about right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Despite some high-profile mass shootings over the last bunch of years and an uptick in less high-profile shootings in cities around the country, it doesn't seem like anyway there's been a lot in the way of changes of gun laws. What have you seen going on over the last decade?
Well, look, at the federal level, there hasn't been any major gun control laws passed since the 1990s. You'd have to go back a quarter century. And in the interim, you've got everything from Columbine to this week's shooting that has happened. So the federal government has been gridlocked on meaningful gun regulation. But most gun regulation, historically and over the past decade or two, is at the state and local level. And we have seen some changes in state and local gun laws. In fact, some states, in the wake of mass shootings, tend to loosen their gun regulations to allow more people to carry guns and to obtain different types of more lethal weapons. Other states, typically Democratic-led states, have tried to respond to the mass shootings by tightening gun restrictions. So after Sandy Hook, for instance, New York State passed the SAFE Act Connecticut acted, other states acted as well, to limit the ability of people to get so-called assault rifles and large capacity magazines, and to require universal background checks and the like. But that has not been the universal approach. So we have a patchwork of state laws now and a patchwork of approaches following these mass shootings.
And those state and local laws are constrained by what the U.S. Supreme Court says is or isn't constitutional. In fairly recent American history, the Supreme Court established that gun ownership is an individual right. This was a pretty big change, right, compared to how courts had ruled for the first couple hundred years.
Yeah, and you're referring to the case in 2008 called District of Columbia v. Heller. And so in that case, the plaintiff, Dick Heller, wanted to have a handgun in his home, unrelated to a militia service. He wanted to have it for self-defense. And Washington, D.C. had a ban on the possession of handguns in the home. And the Supreme Court in that case, for the first time in over 200 years, said that the Second Amendment, which provides a well-regulated militia, be necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, protects not a militia-related right, but a private right related to individual private self-defense from criminals and the like. That case was the first time a federal appellate court had ever in the history of the United States struck down a gun law on Second Amendment grounds. So it was a landmark case, and it's opened the door to a heck of a lot of litigation. In fact, there's one Supreme Court case that is pending right now that could further inhibit the ability of governments to regulate firearms.
I wanted to ask you about that case next, coming out of, I think, New York State.
Right. So this case, it's called Bruin. It's the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin, involves a restriction on carrying handguns in public. Heller, that 2008 case, held that you have a right to have a handgun in your home for self-defense if you're not otherwise disqualified. But the case didn't deal with the ability of carrying handguns in public, where, of course, guns can present externalities and problems for other people. This case addresses that issue. In New York State and other states, in order to get a permit to carry a concealed handgun, you have to show good cause or proper cause. And what that means in eight states that have these policies is that you have to show a heightened need for self-defense, something that separates you from the general public. Saying that you just have a generalizable fear that a stranger might attack you is not enough to get a concealed carry permit in New York. So the plaintiffs in that case didn't have any special security needs that separated them from the general public. And as a result, they did not get an unrestricted permit. Rather, they got permits to carry handguns to and from work and in certain other unpopulated places. And they're saying that that policy violates their Second Amendment rights. And after oral arguments, it seemed like the conservative majority on the Supreme Court right now agrees. And if they were to strike that down, this would be a significant divergence from the consensus view in the lower federal courts, which have by and large upheld these policies. New York's policy, for example, goes back over a century.
What, of course, it depends on how the Supreme Court rules, even if they do overturn this law. What are other laws then that might be challenged under a ruling overturning that law in New York?
Right. And Rob, I think that you hit the nail on the head. A lot depends on how the Supreme Court issues its ruling. So assuming that the majority of the justices are going to strike down New York's law, that will have or at least this proper cause component of New York's law, that will have immediate next day effects for a quarter of Americans who live in places where you have to show this height and self-defense need in order to get a carry a handgun in public. Those places can expect more people carrying handguns in public. And that alone has been associated in the research with an uptick in aggregate violent crime. So that is one thing that people can expect in those places. The data suggests that the increase in other places that have loosened their public carry restrictions can be in the range of 10 to 15% uptick in certain violent crimes. So those places will try to compensate with new laws. But it's also possible the Supreme Court says, look, it's unconstitutional to even require a license to carry a handgun in public. In other words, the permitless carry movement that we're seeing across the country right now is correct about the fact that that is the constitutional standard. Now, I would be surprised if the Supreme Court goes that far, but if they did, that would affect a lot more states' laws. And there's another thing that's at issue in this case that I think is merits attention, which is that the plaintiffs and others in the case are asking the Supreme Court to declare the overall methodology that the lower courts are applying in these cases to be the improper methodology. And instead, they want the Supreme Court to say that in Second Amendment challenges, the constitutionality of a law depends solely on history and tradition, such as the history of gun regulation at the time that the Second Amendment was enacted in 1791, or maybe when the 14th Amendment was enacted in 1868. And it does not care about modern gun violence and modern solutions to modern gun violence. And if that is something that the Supreme Court does, if it says that that is the metric for determining the constitutionality of gun laws, the impact will be much broader than just public carry. In fact, it would affect all weapons laws that have been challenged in the years since Heller. Courts have overwhelmingly upheld gun regulation, largely by virtue of the fact that they determine that gun regulations that are being challenged sufficiently further an important public interest in stopping gun violence today, modern gun violence. If the court makes this methodological change, however, it would reopen litigation across issues. So we'll see new challenges to so-called assault weapon bans, large capacity magazine restrictions, restrictions on who can have a gun, such as whether or not felon in possession laws are unconstitutional, or laws seeking to keep firearms away from the mentally ill. The whole range of firearms laws and knife laws and all other weapons laws would be reopened to constitutional challenge.
We're talking to Eric Rubin, assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University, who studies Second Amendment rights, looking at the status of gun laws in the United States, how they may or may not change in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see changes in gun regulations in one direction or another? Are you a parent worried about sending your kid to school after this week and previous school shootings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Eric Rubin from Southern Methodist University, looking at gun laws and gun reform in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, would you like to see changed? 800-642-1234. Jeremy joins us now in Superior. Jeremy, hello.
Hi, thank you. Every time something like a horrible tragedy like this happens, and it has to involve a firearm, the same thing keeps, same narrative keeps being brought up. Blaming the object, blaming the tool, blaming the gun. It is absolutely ludicrous that this keeps happening, how we're blaming an object for the actions of an individual. And I'm going to use an analogy that I've used quite a bit. If a contractor comes to your home, installs a brand new door, and the door is crooked, do you blame the contractor's hammer, or do you blame the contractor himself?
Well, Jeremy, let me ask you, Jeremy, fully automatic weapons in the country are illegal, almost completely illegal, because people see them as a tool that allows too much lethality. Is there a limit for you for how lethal a tool could be between automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons, where we say maybe that tool lets that bad person do too much damage?
Well, for one, and like you said, fully automatic weapons are illegal in the United States. Semi-automatic weapon is a very, very common weapon and tool used for hunting, sport shooting. I own multiple myself. Never has one of my guns gone off on its own or shot at in anybody's direction. And if anything happens, the trigger needs to be pulled by an individual. And I'm sorry, mental health is the number one issue in this entire debate. It's not guns.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Mental health often not involved in these shootings, Eric. But to his point, do we blame the tool or the person?
Look, I mean, obviously there's not just one thing here, but it's hard to discount the increased lethality of firearms. One of the ironies about the argument that Jeremy was raising is that a lot of gun rights advocates would balk at the suggestion that they should just defend themselves with a knife or with a taser or without any weapon whatsoever. They insist that the firearm itself enables them to better protect themselves. And the same thing happens on the flip side. Firearms are more lethal than other types of weapons. They intensify violence. And the data backs this up. So, you know, one of the quips you might think about is there's no such thing as a drive-by knifing, right? You can use a gun to shoot somebody at distance. If a gun is used in an assault, it is likely to be more lethal than if a different weapon is used. So, yeah, of course, firearms don't shoot themselves. They require the efforts of the shooter as well. But if you have somebody with mental health issues, as Jeremy said, or somebody who is intent on violence, they're going to most likely be more lethal if they can get their hands on a gun, and a gun that can dispel more bullets faster than if they can't. And so I think that's one of the logics between some of the incremental changes that are suggested in terms of gun regulation. Are they going to solve gun violence? No. But would they incrementally perhaps make improvements? I think that that is where the debate really is.
Jeremy, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Jim now in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I think it's important that people maintain the ability to defend themselves. There's not often spoken of, but there's a couple million times a year, it's pretty well documented that violent crimes are prohibited by private ownership of firearms. And the canard about large capacity magazines is also apparent in cases like the elderly gentleman who heard people breaking into his home and defended himself with a 30-round magazine against four armed individuals, each with 15-round magazines in their pistols.
Jim, thanks for the call. Defensive gun use, often cited, Eric, as an argument against gun law changes.
Yeah, so this is obviously one of the big public policy issues in that is going on right now, is that firearms are used defensively. Of course, there are anecdotes of that. Now, I think that a lot of times the number of times and the proportion of self-defense incidents that involve a firearm is exaggerated. The National Crime Victimization Survey, which is the best data that we have on this, suggests that less than 1% of self-defense incidents involve the defensive use of a firearm. As many defensive incidents, according to that survey, involve weapons other than firearms, so think knives and the like. And then well over 90% of self-defense incidents don't involve a weapon at all. But it is true that firearms can be used defensively, just like they can be used offensively. To Jim's point about the fact that if you are attacked by, you know, multiple people who are carrying automatic weapons, would you want to have the firepower to defend against those people? Sure, there's some intuitive value to that, but I think that those types of attacks are less likely. And the question in terms of policy is that you're not going to have a perfect solution to providing people with self-defense in every single situation. You're not going to have the perfect solution to preventing gun violence. You have to weigh the pros and the cons of these different policy solutions. And that ultimately leaves a lot of people dissatisfied.
Thanks for the call. Randy joins us now in Ripon. Randy, hello.
Hi. I just want to point out, I served in the military. I qualified as a marksman. And it's one thing to shoot at a target when you're calm, cool, and relaxed. And I've had friends and acquaintances that carry guns, pistols. And one thing I point out to them, I say, are you fully prepared to pull that gun out and mistakenly kill an innocent person or be mistaken for the bad guy by the authorities? Because the bad guy isn't wearing a sign saying, hey, I'm the bad guy, shoot me. And there could be another fellow doing the same thing you're doing. This is all really naive, thinking you can just whip out a gun and start blasting away and be a hero, because it's real easy to miss when your adrenaline's pumping. That's all I got to say.
Randy, thanks for sharing your experience there. Eric, what do you think?
No, of course. I mean, some of the data involving police shootings is somewhat stark in that police miss their targets a lot, and they have to train repeatedly. And I think that this also brings up another policy that's at issue right now, and it's being debated in Wisconsin and other places, is whether or not we should remove the permitting requirement before you can carry a concealed weapon altogether. And one of the, and this is, you know, called by some advocates for it constitutional carry, it's permitless carry. And one of the things that you give up if you make that change is to get the permit. Most places require you to go through some sort of gun training, some live shooting. And if you remove that, you also remove the requirement that people actually train with their guns. And to Randy's point, even if people are trained, you still miss a lot. And it's a consideration, I think, that should be on the table as we're debating permitless carry.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Eric Rubin, law professor at Southern Methodist University, looking at the politics and law of gun control in the United States. Eric, I don't want to let the time get passed without visiting the U.S. Senate. We talked some about the courts. There is talk of at least some kind of negotiation among Democrats and Republicans to do something. TBD right now. What kind of things are you watching for in the U.S. Senate?
You know, I mentioned this before, there hasn't been any significant gun safety regulation at the federal level for a quarter century. Anything that comes out of the Senate would be a big deal because of that. Though I imagine anything would be disappointing to a lot of gun safety advocates. And it's unclear what exactly is on the table. One of the policies that might have legs is a measure to incentivize states that have not already adopted red flag laws, which permit a family member or a law enforcement or in some places school administrators to petition to remove guns from somebody who is showing an acute threat to themselves or to others. One of the policies would incentivize states to adopt those reforms. 19 states have already done it, including plus the District of Columbia. And why that might have legs, especially amongst Republican caucus that tends to oppose any restrictions on firearm possession, is that the measure wouldn't actually mandate anything. It would leave it up to individual states and provide funding for the states themselves to decide whether or not to implement these policies. And so it would shift the debate back to the states. And some places like Oklahoma have already made clear that they would not adopt this measure. Oklahoma has recently passed an anti-red flag law. So that's one of the, you know, that's the sort of thing that I'm watching for. It would, you know, it would be promising if there could be some bipartisan agreement on gun regulation, but most likely it wouldn't be strong regulation that you'd see coming out of the Senate.
And briefly, Eric, we're hearing a lot of different things from the police in this particular horrific shooting. One sentiment is that they felt like they were outgunned by the perpetrator with an AR-15 platform rifle. Do you see the police being a factor in limiting potentially the kinds of guns that are available in just our last few moments?
Yeah. So, I mean, police have consistently come out against various legislation that loosens gun restrictions for this very reason. And what you saw about the police feeling outgunned in this case, you also saw in Charlottesville, if you recall the protests. There, police felt that the armed protesters outgunned them. You see this in other places, in Dallas here, in fact. In Dallas, the shooting that happened in downtown Dallas, police felt outgunned. And this is, I think, something to think about when we consider the types of weapons that individuals have.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Eric Rubin, assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University, fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, studying Second Amendment rights. He's with us today to talk about lack of changes in federal gun laws despite a string of mass shootings over the years. Coming up Monday on Central Time, they are the social media of their day, and you could still use them to send unique messages. We'll check out the history of the postcard. And our skills and talents may change as we get older. That can be good news. We'll talk to the author of the new book, From Strength to Strength. That and more Monday on Central Time.